Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. Today we're going to do pages 85 to 107 of the Volume 3, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, book by the researchers with the Nation of Islam, NOI. And we've already done three sessions. I believe this is the fourth, and this will be the section, there are no numbered chapters, The Trial of Leo Frank. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. That's my forum, and also at alexlinder.com, my personal page, where I have maybe a dozen to 20 books permanently archived, and eventually everything I do will end up there. Let's get going. The Trial of Leo Frank. Couple epigraphs to start. Again, I will do bits of the footnotes. There's lots of footnotes. Get the book if you want. Buy it from NOI. Keep the money out of the hands of the Jews at Amazon if you want to get it and do research. And most of the footnotes are to the handful of books written about the Leo Frank case and the daily newspaper cover back then 100 years ago in 1913. Anyway, The Trial of Leo Frank, picking up on page 85, two epigraphs. First one, their defense of Frank was largely an asserting of his, and by extension, their own whiteness. Dr. Stuart Rockoff, presumably a Jew, R-O-C-K-O-F-F, director of the Goldring / Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life, Goldring-Woldenberg Institute of Southern Jewish Life, and the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience. Jews were mainly in Charleston. They dominated not only the trade to bring, not only the slave trade, that is, bringing slaves to America, but they dominated the slave production trade, that is, the stuff that the agricultural stuff the slaves were used to produce. They were the middlemen and the wholesalers and the forerunners of the stock market, the buyers of that stuff, just as they had been in Europe, where they dominated that even in Germany. Second epigraph. Much about Frank's life signified his whiteness. The African-American servants who worked in the home he and his wife shared with her parents. His control of poor African-Americans and whites in the National Pencil Company factory, and his conversion of an empty jail cell next to his own into a parlor to greet visitors, all these indicated that Frank was a bourgeois white man. That's from Jeffrey Melnick, M-E-L-N-I-C-K, 174, footnote. Melnick, Black Jewish Relations, 39, also Oni, A-T-D-S-R, one of the main books on it, 532, one of the main books written by a Jew on it. Jaher, Leo Frank, 36, Frank flourished in an atmosphere of culture and wealth. Then Oni, Frank was ascending to the top of Atlanta's German Jewish aristocracy. Since arriving in Georgia, Frank had enjoyed a propitious rise. Frank's world was one of culture and privilege. Leo Frank's murder trial began on July 28, 1913, and was the longest and most expensive criminal trial in Georgia state history up to that time. Longest and most expensive, and he had the best attorneys, and had the most money spent on his case. From gavel to gavel, it lasted 29 days, more than 300 witnesses were subpoenaed, and the transcript of court testimony amounted to 1,080,060 words. World War I was raging, but it had to share Atlanta's front pages with Leo Frank. Footnote 175. The transcript was lost or stolen from the public record sometime in the 1960s, and that is something that Jews specialize in, where before the computer age, before there's lots of copies of things, they steal originals so no one can ever find stuff. That's less effective with the internet, but that is an absolutely time-honored Jewish practice, a supplement to their incessant lying in any media they control. Now, turning on to 86, a few inset photos, which those are really effective in this book. They have a whole lot of them. Judge Leonard Roan, Hugh M. Dorsey, so the judge, the main prosecutor, they slander in today's, they libel in Parade, which is the lie-based musical they now present and tour around the country about the Leo Frank case, portraying him as a victim. And portraying Hugh M. Dorsey, the prosecutor, as a bad guy. In fact, he was a good guy. Luther Z. Rosser, who was Leo Frank's, one of his main two attorneys, and Reuben Arnold, who I believe was the other one. Again, best defense money could buy. First case where basically a black man's word was taken over a white man's, unheard of, where the white man, the Jew, that is, refused to face his accuser before the trial, and they were much more open about that stuff then. They didn't have all these rules where you couldn't, that really, really effectively, functionally protected the guilty. Back then, they were much quicker to do things. You see, this trial is taking place at the end of July. The crime itself took place at the end of April. So April to May, June, July, within or 3 months and a couple days, they're already going to trial, the biggest trial in their state history. Think about that. So justice was fairly quick, even for an extremely major case. Page 86. Aspects of the murder investigation, the trial, and the events that followed were in many respects just as ugly as the murder. There were claims that witnesses were tortured, that affidavits and confessions were forged, that bribery was rife, that perjury was rampant, and that false evidence was planted. Witnesses testified, then recanted their testimonies, and then recanted their recantations. There were illegal arrests and detentions, public access to the prisoners, witnesses, and evidence, multiple and competing public and private investigations, high crimes, misdemeanors, and blatant conflicts of interest. There was even, yes, a bloody glove. They're alluding to the OJ case. 176, footnote after that. Fagan Mystery Club examined by experts. The report of a bloody glove apparently having been worn by a young girl having been found in the pencil factory was also in circulation Wednesday. Bloodstained glove of Mary Fagan is said to have been found on the first floor near the place of the discovery of her pay envelope was made. Attorneys openly expressed their anti-black racism in the courtroom and to the press. Again, the term racism was not even invented at that date. It would be another 15 years before the Jew communist Trotsky and the Jew queer pervert and bordello operator masquerading as an institute of scientific sex study, Magnus Hirschfeld, would popularize the term racism. This is 1913, and that was 1927 and after, as the Jews and Jew communists and Nazis were doing battle in Germany. Anyway, so when just keep that in mind when he's using the term racism to talk about this trial. That was a word that no one used back then because it had not effectively been invented, popularized, spread. So attorneys openly expressed their anti-black views in the courtroom and to the press, and the trial proceedings were infused with lurid accounts of sex and violence. Other issues lurk just beneath the surface of the Leo Frank case. Child factory labor, class-based North-South animosities, pedophilia and sexual deviance, and the widespread indignation over the criminal outrage committed against a poor daughter of the South. Ironically, the only social sin that was almost completely absent from the trial was that which many Jews would later claim dominated the proceedings, anti-Semitism. So, in other words, animosity or antipathy or animus against the Jew was wholly non-existent from this trial, yet Jewish liars of after the trial would claim that it dominated and was the reason for the result, not just the lynching but the conviction, because they claim he's innocent. So Jews are complete and utter liars, and it's not just one or two Jews, it's the entire tribe, essentially. And while there may be a few genetic outliers who aren't born that way, they will eventually spin off from the tribe or keep their mouths shut. Every public known Jew is a liar, essentially. Despite all of the above, the trial of Leo Frank itself maintained a relatively sturdy judicial form. Indeed, a close analysis of the official trial record and the extensive day-by-day media accounts reveals the trial of the B'nai B'rith president may have been the fairest ever seen in an American Southern courtroom. A long-experienced Judge Leonard S. Roan presided, and the prosecutor for the state of Georgia, Hugh M. Dorsey, had presented his case against Leo Frank to a grand jury, five of whose members were Jews, who in turn handed up the murder indictment. So his own people found him indictable. 5 of the 23 were Jews. The trial was conducted, as was all public business in Atlanta, within the strict racial guidelines decreed by Jim Crow. Whites swore in a whites-only Bible. Blacks swore in a separate Negro Bible, quote-unquote, with those of the Jewish faith swearing on the white one. Frank entered the courtroom at the head of an army of attorneys, the ADL counting at least 8. Among his lead attorneys was Herbert J. Haas, H-A-A-S, a B'nai B'rith member who hailed from one of Atlanta's most prominent families of German-Jewish aristocrats. Haas chose 2 prominent Gentile lawyers to conduct Frank's courtroom defense, the legendary cross-examiner Luther Z. Rosser and the unyielding Georgia bulldog Reuben R. Arnold. Both fully ensconced in the Southern justice system and fully accepting of its legal vagaries. They had but one assignment, to wrap a formidable legal noose around the black neck of the state's prime witness, James Jim Conley. The Georgian could not wait for this, quote, most thrilling situation, unquote, block quote. Anyone who has seen a witness made the object of Rosser's attack knows that Jim Conley is in for a bad day when he was called to the stand. Rosser's plan opens up the dramatic possibility of a courtroom confession from Conley. Luther Rosser came with an additional advantage for the defense. He had once been Judge Roan's law partner, and he had recently welcomed a new attorney and partner into his law firm, the newly elected governor of Georgia, John M. Slayton, the one who would later commute Leo Frank's sentence. So I don't know if these are typically enough to recuse, but they certainly might be used for that reason. But there's a close connection between the judge and the defense attorneys and the governor. So everything in the social customs, the law, and the personal relations in the court is in favor of Leo Frank. The only thing against him is the goddamn facts. Keep that in mind when you read all these Jewish lies that still circulate because the Jews control the media. Put up a Google News alert on Leo Frank and you'll see what I mean. Stupid goyim, pathetic goyim who, oh my gosh, these issues that are still with us, horrible anti-something, not the least knowledge or interest in knowing the true facts of the situation. Pathetic. Even at this early stage, it escaped no one's notice that Slayton's occupying the state's highest office carried with it the pardon power to override an adverse verdict. And though Governor Slayton had, by law, distanced himself from the firm, he yet maintained an office there with his name still inscribed on the door. And all those substantial benefits would prove to be useful as events unfolded. Footnote 181. According to Fagan Keene, the murder, Judge Roan was Rosser's senior law partner from 1883 to 1886. It is noteworthy that the firm of Rosser, Brandon, Slayton, and Phillips also represented Jewish businessman Oscar Elsass, who sat on the grand jury in the Frank case. See Clifford M. Kuhn, K-U-H-N, in Contesting the New South Order. Frank himself assisted his defense team as they chose an all-white, all-male jury of 12 from a pool of 96, rejecting all blacks out of hand, which today they would say is racist and illegal. On the voir dire, where they or supposedly have can reject anyone for any reason, but in fact they can't. Footnote 182, description of jurors in Atlanta Constitution. In the South, jury duty was determined by voting lists. Much of the recorded racial terrorism that occurred against blacks in the South focused on keeping blacks from the polls. So whereas a substantial number of blacks were registered to vote, few actually did. In the Frank case, 4 or 5 of those called to duty were black. Of the jury of 12 of Frank's white male peers, all but 1 was married, and 5 were fathers. Their employment ranged from a bank teller, a bookkeeper, a real estate agent, a manufacturer, and a contractor, to an optician, a claim agent, a mailing clerk, 2 salesmen, and 2 machinists. It was an ironic element at the opening of a trial in which the contribution of blacks would prove pivotal to his legal fate. Next section, or subsection, Black Power on the Witness Stand. three epigraphs. First, from the Talmud, Pesachim 49b. We do not give testimony in front of him. We do not summons him to be a witness, and we do not accept testimony from him. And who is the him? It doesn't say. I don't know if it's blacks or goyim. My character has been blackened by those who sought my conviction, said Leo Frank. And then finally, Luther Rosser, in his closing argument, an epigraph, you can't get a man with Anglo-Saxon blood to admit he lied. He has pride. I have never seen one admit he lied. No matter where he is born, he has that same Anglo-Saxon pride. Now, with a Negro, it is different. He will admit he lied. Jim Conley, without any character to protect, lied this way and lied that. Again, Luther Rosser in his closing argument. Atlanta was in the midst of a heat wave as the trial of Leo Frank got underway. Readers of William Randolph Hearst's upstart Atlanta Georgian would have seen the bold headline above the masthead, Trial of Leo Frank Begins. And beneath they would find a much smaller but infinitely more grotesque reminder of exactly where they were geographically and historically. Quote, Dunbar is quiet after lynching. The brief notice detailed how members of a mob of Georgia Caucasians chased, quote, Negro John Sake, S-A-K-E, into a swamp and strung him up to a pole and literally riddled his body with bullets. In four speedy paragraphs describing an even speedier affair, another black man was tried, convicted, sentenced, and executed by a white mob that, quote, dispersed immediately, and not a clue remains. Back then they spelled clue, C-L-E-W. 50 more such beastly racial attacks would occur in America in 1913. Blacks were as horrified as whites were pleased that their justice system worked so efficiently. Most assuredly, the blacks whose testimony would be prominently featured in the days to come understood what was at stake. The contrast between America's two, quote, systems of justice could not have been made clearer. Prosecutor Hugh Manson Dorsey opened with a careful and systematic presentation of the state's theory of the crime. He had amassed a body of circumstantial evidence against the defendant that was fortified with scores of witnesses and with the physical evidence of bloodstains and hair. He would argue that a violent event had occurred on the second floor, where Leo Frank's office was located, and that Mary Fagan was never seen alive again after she had met with her boss. That evidence had been enough to convince Frank's own hired private eyes of his guilt, and more important, it was enough to generate an indictment from a grand jury with several Jewish members. Now Dorsey would put that evidence to the ultimate test, in front of a jury. There's a graphic, July 28th, 1913, a picture, actually. First day of the trial of Leo Frank, Newt Lee, the factory night watchman who discovered the body, is on the witness stand on the far right. Leo Frank is at the center facing Cameron. He's got his legs crossed over the knee and his arms crossed sitting on his lap and looking very small and defensive. The pencil company employee who discovered Mary Fagan's body in the factory basement in the early morning hours of April 27th, the much maligned, falsely accused, and nearly lynched night watchman, was sworn in and entered into the official record as Newt Lee, parentheses, colored. Colored was a persecutional tag that Leo Frank would never have to countenance or confront. Footnote 185, even the official brief of evidence of the case demonstrates bias against James Conley and favors Frank. The table of contents directs the reader with these entries, quote, witnesses attacking Frank's character good, character of Leo M. Frank good, Conley, Jim, character for veracity bad, Conley, Jim, character of for veracity bad, Conley's character bad. When Lee was sworn and able to present his account of the episode, his testimony was so forthright, his demeanor so self-assured, that the Atlanta Constitution's reporter felt compelled to observe that even under Luther Rosser's legendary cross-examination, quote, Lee stuck to his original story in the minutest detail. Questions that would have confused or befuddled a man of education failed to budge him from the statements he originally made to the police. Seasoned courthouse officials and old reporters marveled at the way the Negro held out against the crossfire of questions, all aimed to confuse him. And with a confident and entirely reasonable self-defense, Newt Lee unloosed the rope from his own neck and slammed the door on Leo Frank's intention to make him complicit for the crime he simply discovered. In fact, it was Frank alone who had continued to target his former night watchman, goading the police and the city newspapers to keep the suspicion of Lee alive. But as the murder investigation pressed forward, nearly all involved, from the chief of police to the newspapermen to private investigators, publicly proclaimed Lee's innocence several weeks before the trial. Atlanta's chief of detectives, Newport Lanford, was clear. Quote, Lee has completely been eliminated from the case as a suspect and is now counted as one of the strongest witnesses against Frank. Quote, there is not the slightest doubt of the innocence of Newt Lee. I'm certain he has told all he knows of the death of Mary Fagan. Now at trial, Lee could speak for himself. So effectively did Newt Lee rebuff the Frank team's maneuver that the newspapers were speculating his release from custody might occur within a couple of days. There's a footnote there. Newt Lee may get his freedom today. The racism of the Atlanta Constitution, not anti-Semitism, was irrepressible and typical media fare. Quote, what will become of Lee is not known. If the darkie had his choice, he would probably be set down in a watermelon patch. This, again, 100 years ago, this is how quickly things human change. Just think about this in relation to today. This was printed in the Atlanta Constitution. What will become of Lee is not known. If the darkie had his choice, he would probably be set down in a watermelon patch where the melons grow eternal and where the little curly cues on the ends of the luscious fruit sprouted forth ample quids of bacca, chewing tobacco. It was for a melon that Newt pined while in jail, and it was for a chaw of bacca that he pleaded when attorney Luther Rosser finished his grueling cross-examination Tuesday. I mean, God damn if things changed in America, and all under the guidance of the Jews, and all for the worse. Thus, on the very first day of his trial, Frank was given his first cold reality check by the very black man he had so vigorously tried to implicate. The racial profiling Frank had planned as a defense strategy would not be the easy victory he anticipated. New subsection, Jim Connolly testifies. So again, the two blacks involved, Jim Connolly, we're about to hear about again, the janitor, the sweeper, the man used to kind of protect his privacy when he had his assignations with various white women he was debauching who were not his wife, was Jim Connolly, and the night watchman he tried to frame and he messed up the time slip on was Newt Lee. But so on the first day of the trial, Newt Lee gets up there and pretty much Rother can't shake him, even though Rosser is supposedly the best defender out there, the best cross-examiner out there in the state, can't shake this mere Negro. And again, epigraph, and Jim Connolly testifies, epigraph from Luther Rosser in his closing argument. This Negro is no ordinary Negro. Did you notice him on the stand? What's your name? James Connolly. That's the way he answered me, James. Did you notice it? It wasn't Jim. Maybe one time when he wallowed in the mire of the streets, it was Jim. But after some sinister man had shaved and bathed and pampered him and used scented soap in his hair, why, he was James. Luther Rosser in his closing argument. With Newt Lee fully acquitting himself, it was clear that the appearance of James, quote, Jim Connolly, the confessed accessory after the fact, would be the most anticipated showdown of the trial. As far as Frank's attorneys were concerned, if their client were going to be exonerated, the factory sweeper's testimony and his very character simply had to be destroyed. Prosecutor Dorsey was taking a major risk by arranging such a racial confrontation in a southern courtroom. Quote, Negro testimony, unquote, as the courts referred to it, was simply worthless in all legal matters. Yet for the first time in American history, Dorsey intended to use it to erect the gallows by which to hang a white man of wealth and standing. It was an astonishing departure from all Southern racial customs and uncharted legal territory. But Connolly's uncanny ability to recall and relay crucial details of the crime emboldened the prosecutor to take that risk. Well, really, what else did he have to use? Moving with dispatch, Dorsey continued to reconstruct the events of April 26th to establish the last known movements, actions, and words of the 13-year-old victim, Mary Fagan. Her family, her friends, and her co-workers helped chart her last 24 hours. Police first responders and detectives recounted the gruesome discovery of the body and the related clues. Dorsey meticulously laid out the strands of evidentiary facts for his much-anticipated main witness to weave together. On August 4th, James Conley was called to the stand, and the sheer drama of his presence in the witness box mesmerized all of Georgia. He would be on the stand for 16 hours, longer than any other witness in state history up to that time. Pretty remarkable, isn't it? The black man calmly and cogently gave a riveting and unflustered account of the role his boss had instructed him to perform in the aftermath of Mary Fagan's murder. Conley's gift for recounting the details and the nuances of his experience, by all accounts, was extraordinary. It quickly became evident why Prosecutor Dorsey had placed so much confidence in the simple, quote, Negro sweeper. Through a race-fogged lens, the Atlanta Georgian reporter observed, quote, the Negro forgot nothing, omitted nothing that he had told before. If he was telling a black lie to save his own neck from the gallows, it was still more wonderful. He had a remarkably retentive memory or an imagination far beyond the normal, even for his notably imaginative race. So fast the words fell from his lips that the stenographers were hard put to keep up with him, and the jurors, straining forward in their seats, found difficulty in following his recital. He sat there, an uncouth, thick-lipped, ignorant Negro, but he told a story that gripped his auditors with a compelling interest that an eloquent-tongued orator could not have aroused. At its core, Conley's witness stand narrative was solid and unwavering. Attorney Luther Rosser later charged that Atlanta detectives had concocted this story and coached the Negro, but that was unlikely. Conley's minute-by-minute account was honeycombed with any number of opportunities for impeachment. That is, if he'd said something false or wrong that they could prove. For instance, here Conley tells of his prearranged meeting with Frank on the morning of the murder and his recruitment to be the, quote, lookout for his boss later that day. Note, the sheer number of witnesses Conley refers to who could have been found to dispute or deny his account. Georgian had to have understood that a coached liar would not have built into his story so many chances for exposure. Long block quote here. On April 26th, me and Mr. Frank met at the door. He says, what I want you to do is watch for me today as you did other Saturdays. And I says, all right. I said, Mr. Frank, I want to go to the Capital City Laundry to see my mother. And he said, by the time you go to the laundry and come back to Trinity Avenue, stop at the corner of Nelson and Forsyth Streets until I go to Montag's. I don't know exactly what time I got to the corner of Nelson and Forsyth Streets, but I came there sometime between 10 and 10:30. I saw Mr. Frank as he passed me by. I was standing on the corner. He was coming up Forsyth Street toward Nelson Street. He was going to Montag's factory. And then there's a picture, an artist rendering of James Conley on the witness stand with, left to right, Reuben Arnold, Luther Rosser, and Judge Leonard Roan from the Atlanta Georgian. Continuing with the testimony from Conley, while I was there in the corner, he said, ha-ha, you are here. You're here, is you? And I said, yes, sir, I'm right here, Mr. Frank. He says, well, wait until I go to Mr. Siggs, that's Montag's. I won't be very long, I'll be right back. I says, all right, Mr. Frank, I'll be right here. I don't know how long he stayed at Montag's. He didn't say anything when he came back from Montag's, but told me to come on. Mr. Frank came out Nelson Street and down Forsyth Street toward the pencil factory, and I followed right behind. As we passed up there, the grocery store, Albertson Brothers, a young man was up there with a paper sack getting some stuff out of a box on the sidewalk, and he had his little baby standing by the side of him, and just as Mr. Frank passed by him, I was a little behind Mr. Frank, and Mr. Frank said something to me, and by him looking back at me and saying something to me, he hit up against the man's baby, and the man turned around and looked to see who it was, and he looked directly in my face, but I never did catch the idea what Mr. Frank said. Mr. Frank stopped at Curtis's drugstore, corner Mitchell and Forsyth Streets, went into the soda fountain. He came out and went straight on to the factory, me right behind him. So, this is not the kind of thing that would be easy to make up or coach someone on, for sure. They're very, very easy to forget any aspect of it. Unless it had actually happened, you pretty much can guarantee that that's real. Conley has described encounters with several specific individuals and in several specific places before he has even arrived at the scene of the crime. He said that a number of draymen had seen him with Frank as well. And all those points of impeachment are superfluous to the murder plot and unnecessarily risky if they were untrue. In fact, area resident Hattie Waits, a white woman, said she did indeed see Frank on the street in, quote, close conversation with a Negro, verifying Conley's account. He continues, discussing his prearranged meeting and the familiar task he was given by Leo Frank, quote, I want you to watch for me like you've been doing the rest of the Saturdays, unquote. I always stayed on the first floor, like I stayed the 26th of April, and watched for Mr. Frank while he and a young lady would be up on the second floor chatting. I don't know what they were doing. He only told me they wanted to chat. When young ladies would come there, I would sit down at the first floor and watch the door for him. Again, the door from a door midway on the steps from the first floor up to the second where Frank's office was. That door could be locked, so no one could get up there. I couldn't exactly tell how many times I have watched the door for him previous to April 26. It has been several times that I watched for him. I don't know who would be there when I watched for him, but there would be another young man and another young lady during the time I was at the door, a lady for him and one for Mr. Frank. Conley then outlines his assignment at the factory on the day of Mary Fagan's murder. When we got to the factory, we both went on the inside, and Mr. Frank stopped me at the door, and when he stopped me at the door, he put his hand on the door and turned the door and says, you see, you turn the knob just like this, and there can't nobody come in from the outside. And I says, all right. And I walked back to a little box back there by the trash barrel. He told me to push the box up against the trash barrel and sit on it, and he says, now there will be a young lady up here after a while, and me and her are going to chat a little. And he says, now when the lady comes, I will stomp like I did before. And he says, that will be the lady, and you go and shut the door. And I says, all right, sir. And he says, now when I whistle, I will be through, so you can go and unlock the door, and you come upstairs to my office, then, like you were going to borrow some money from me, and that will give the young lady time to get out. I says, all right, I will do just as you say, and I did as he said. Mr. Frank hit me a little blow on my chest and says, now, whatever you do, don't let Mr. Darley see you. I says, all right, I won't let him see me. Mr. Darley is a personnel manager. Then Mr. Frank went upstairs and he said, remember to keep your eyes open. And I says, all right, I will, Mr. Frank. And I sat there on the box, and that was the last I seen of Mr. Frank until up in the day sometime. Conley then told of what he had witnessed while sitting in the first floor stairwell, the people who went up and down the staircase, the details of what they wore and what they did. He watched Mary Fagan enter the factory door and go up the stairs to Frank's office. Conley told of the events immediately preceding the murder. And then before we get to that, there's a graphic, let's see, Leo, whole page graphic, Leo Frank's meeting with James Conley on the morning of the murder. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, meets Conley at the door, and tells him to meet him later near Montag Brothers. Conley goes to Capital Laundry on Mitchell Street. 2, Conley meets Frank here on his way to Montag Brothers. 3, Mrs. Hattie Waits observes Frank and Conley in close conversation. 4, Frank stays at Montag Brothers until 11 a.m. 5, Frank walks with Conley back to the factory, gives instructions on watch-out duties. 6, Conley sits behind boxes near the first floor stairwell. Leo Frank goes to his second floor office and waits for Mary Fagan, who arrives at 12:03 p.m. So, Conley told of events immediately preceding the murder as we flip on to 98. Mary Fagan enters. The next person that I saw was Miss Mary Perkins. That's what I call her, this lady that is dead. and that's footnote 197, Connolly is here misstating Mary Fagan's name, confusing it with that of a Factory Four lady, Mary Perk. I don't know her name. After she went upstairs, I heard her footsteps going towards the office, and after she went into the office, I heard two people walking out of the office and going like they were coming down the steps, but they didn't come down the steps. They went back towards the metal department. After they went back there, I heard the lady scream, then I didn't hear no more. And the other one, other thing before the murder, Montine Stover enters. And the next person I saw coming in there was Miss Montine Stover. She had on a pair of tennis shoes and a raincoat. She stayed there a pretty good while. It wasn't so very long either. She came down the steps and left. After she came back down the steps and left, I heard somebody from the metal department come running from back there upstairs on their tiptoes, and then I heard somebody tiptoeing back toward the metal department. After that, I kind of dozed off and went to sleep. And then Connolly describes how a distraught Leo Frank confessed to him about having killed Mary Fagan. Leo Frank panics. Next thing I knew, Mr. Frank was up over my head stamping, and then I went and locked the door and sat on the box a little while, and the next thing I heard was Mr. Frank whistling. I don't know how many minutes it was after that I heard him whistle. When I heard him whistling, I went and unlocked the door, just like he said, and went on up the steps. Mr. Frank was standing up there at the top of the steps and shivering and trembling and rubbing his hands like this. He had a little rope in his hands, a long, wide piece of cord. His eyes were large, and they looked right funny. He looked funny out of his eyes. His face was red. Yes, he had a cord in his hands, just like this here cord. Frank confesses the murder to Connolly. After I got up to the top of the steps, he asked me, "Did you see that little girl who passed here just a while ago?" And I told him I saw one come along there, and she come back again, and then I saw another one come along there, and she hasn't come back down, and he says, "Well, that one you say didn't come back down. She came into my office a while ago and wanted to know something about her work in my office. And I went back there to see if the little girl's work had come. And I wanted to be with the little girl. And she refused me. And I struck her. And I guess I struck her too hard. And she fell and hit her head against something. And I don't know how bad she got hurt." Then a graphic from the Atlanta Constitution of its paper. Connolly grilled 5 hours by Luther Rosser. Connolly recounted several of Frank's trysts that he had witnessed. Then Connolly resumes his account of finding the body of Mary Fagan. Frank orders cover-up. He asked me if I wouldn't go back there and bring her up so that he could put her up somewhere. And he said to hurry that there would be money in it for me. When I came back there, I found the lady lying flat on her back with a rope around her neck. The cloth was also tied around her neck, and part of it was under her head to catch blood. I noticed the clock after I went back there and found the lady was dead and came back and told him. The clock was 1:04. She was dead when I went back there, and I came back and told Mr. Frank the girl was dead, and he said, "Shh." He told me to go back there by the cotton box, get a piece of cloth, put it around her, and bring her up. Flipping on to 100. Moving the body of Mary Fagan. The girl was lying flat on her back, and her hands were out this way. I put both of her hands down easily and rolled her up in the cloth, and taken the cloth and tied her up, and started to pick her up, and I looked back a little distance and saw her hat and a piece of ribbon laying down, and her slippers, and I had taken them and put them all in the cloth, and I ran my right arm through the cloth and tried to bring it up in my shoulder. The cloth was tied just like a person that was going to give out clothes on Monday. They get the clothes and put them on the inside of a sheet, and take each corner and tie the four corners together, and I run my right arm through the cloth after I tied it that way and went to put it on my shoulder, and I found I couldn't get it on my shoulder. It was heavy, and I carried it on my arm the best I could, and when I got away from the little dressing room that was in the metal department, I let her fall, and I was scared, and I kind of jumped, and I said, "Mr. Frank, you will have to help me with this girl. She is heavy." And he come and caught her by the feet, and I laid hold of her by the shoulders, and when we got her that way, I was backing up, and Mr. Frank had her by the feet, and Mr. Frank kind of put her on me. Taking Mary Fagan to the basement. He was nervous and trembling, and after we got up a piece from where we got her at, he let her feet drop, and then he picked her up, and we went on to the elevator, and he pulled down on one of the cords, and the elevator wouldn't go. And he said, "Wait, let me go in the office and get the key." And he went in the office and got the key and come back and unlocked the switchboard, and the elevator went down to the basement, and we carried her out, and I opened the cloth and rolled her out there in the floor. And Mr. Frank turned around and went up on the ladder, and I noticed her hat and slipper and piece of ribbon, and I said, "Mr. Frank, what am I going to do with these things?" And he said, "Just leave them right there." And I take the things and pitches them over in front of the boiler. A graphic of them carrying the body, like a picture. Not a photo, obviously, just a rendering. Back to Frank's second floor office. And after Mr. Frank had left, I goes on over to the elevator and he said, "Come on up and I will catch you on the first floor." And I got on the elevator and started it to the first floor, and Mr. Frank was running up there. He didn't give me time to stop the elevator. He was so nervous and trembly. And before the elevator got to the top of the first floor, Mr. Frank made the first step onto the elevator. And by the elevator being a little down like that, he stepped down on it and hit me quite a blow right over my chest. And that jammed me up against the elevator. And when we got near the second floor, he tried to step off before it got to the floor. And his foot caught on the second floor as he was stepping off. And that made him stumble, and he fell back sort of against me. And he goes on and takes the keys back to his office and leaves the box unlocked. I followed him into his private office, and I sat down, and he commenced to rubbing his hands and began to rub back his hair. And after a while, he got up and said, "Jim," and I didn't say nothing. By this point, James Connolly had established a logical murder scenario and timeline that corroborated key witnesses and contextualized the physical evidence. The jurors were kept at the edge of their seats and strained to take in every word, every inflection, every pause, and every nuance. The courtroom audience was equally captivated and convinced that, for the first time, they were hearing the truth of Mary Fagan's murder. Connolly was able to present an account of the tragedy and to give it life apart from his own persona, such that even if Frank's lawyers destroyed his own personal character, his story was strong enough to stand on its own merits. Leo Frank was in a position never seen in the South, a white man on the defensive. And yet there was more to come. A bump in the road? The wardrobe incident. Though rock solid at its core, Connolly's story was yet frayed around the edges. Critics charged that he seemed to forget some important points and that he evaded others. They target an odd element of his testimony that has come to be known as the wardrobe incident, which he says occurred in Frank's office after returning from moving the body of Mary Fagan to the basement. Connolly's accusers and critics use the episode to invalidate his timeline and as proof that his entire testimony is an elaborate invention. It is the only section that seems to be impeached by the testimony of the women involved. Here is how Connolly described it on the witness stand. "And all at once he, Frank, happened to look out of the door, and there was somebody coming, and he said, 'My God, here is Emma Clark in Corinthia Hall.' And he said, 'Come over here, Jim. I have got to put you in this wardrobe,' large wood cabinet. And he put me in this wardrobe, and I stayed there a good while, and they came in and I heard them go out, and Mr. Frank come there and said, 'You were in a tight place.' And I said, 'Yes.' And he said, 'You done very well.' So after they went out, and he had stepped in the hall and had come back, he let me out of the wardrobe, and he said, 'You sit down.' And I went and sat down, and Mr. Frank sat down." What's interesting about this portion of Connolly's narrative is that it is entirely unnecessary to the storyline of the murder. If it were not included, it would have no positive effect or negative on the murder effect on the murder timeline. Yet Connolly includes the episode in two of his four affidavits and in his court testimony. But by Connolly's timeline, this occurred after the murder. But the women he named, Emma Clark and Corinthia Hall, clearly had arrived and departed well before Mary Fagan arrived at the factory, so before noon. They must have been there. It is an odd feature of his story, if only because it presents an easy opportunity for exposure, a true gotcha moment. Certainly, if Connolly were trained or prepped by the police and prosecutors to give his testimony, as has been charged, this portion would never have been included in an otherwise convincing story. So why did Connolly continue to repeat this wardrobe incident whenever he spoke of the case? If one follows Connolly's description, he and Frank had just returned to Frank's second-floor office after concealing the body in the basement. Frank at that moment would have understood that the only living witness to his crime was, quote, the Negro Connolly. In his panicked assessment, could Frank have understood what any murder mystery reader understands, that to escape undetected, all witnesses must be silenced or even killed? Although he vacillates slightly on what exactly he heard, in none of Conley's accounts does he ever claim to have ever seen the two visitors. He is reacting only to Frank's claim that they were approaching. He then gets in the cabinet and is left in an extremely uncomfortable, hot and sweating condition, and because of the wardrobe's latch mechanism, Conley is able to escape its coffin-like confines only when Frank lets him out. While locked in the wardrobe, Conley said, he could not hear the women talking and surmises that Frank must have taken them to an upper floor. In Conley's third sworn affidavit to police on May 28, 1913, he remembers the incident, but this time he says, I just heard Miss Emma say, good morning, Mr. Frank, are you alone? And Mr. Frank said, yes. But Conley immediately follows that claim with an apparent contradiction about what he had actually heard. Quote, and I couldn't hear them say nothing else, but I didn't know it was Miss Corinthia Hall until Mr. Frank spoke and said it was. But I heard Miss Emma's voice. They didn't stay there long until they were gone. I didn't hear them. I couldn't hear them talking, only I heard Miss Emma say good morning. If they had been talking loud, I could have heard them, but if they were talking low, I couldn't. Though he insists that the wardrobe incident occurred, Conley is less confident about what exactly he heard while locked in the cabinet. Did Frank say that he saw the two women approaching to trick Conley into jumping willingly into his own grave? Conley himself seems conflicted about that aspect of the murder case. Could it have been Leo Frank pretending to be speaking with the women and answering aloud as if he were having a conversation with them? Could Frank have been feminizing his voice and mimicking the women's earlier morning visit? Policeman W.W. Rogers did report that Frank's voice sounded, quote, ladylike, unquote, quote, somewhat like a woman's, unquote. At the time of the incident, Mrs. White had already left for the day and had seen Conley on her way down the front stairs. She believed it to be about 12:50. Frank's own testimony confirms that his whole purpose in asking her to leave was to lock the factory building's outside door. So a surprise entry by Hall and Clark, as claimed by Frank, would have been impossible. This feigned visit is possibly the very moment when Frank considered the desperate choices he faced. If he carried the scheme through and suffocated Conley, how would he dispose of that body? Fagan's body was so awkwardly heavy that it required two men to move it, and Conley's would be considerably heavier for the slightly built superintendent to handle alone. How would he explain the disappearance of two people on his watch? What if Conley figured out his boss's plan and broke out of the cabinet? Was Conley describing the wardrobe incident in this interview with a Constitution reporter? Quote, I didn't get scared of Mr. Frank but once, and I don't want to tell what caused me to be afraid then. I went on ahead with a body like he told me to, because I had been drinking and wasn't exactly in my right mind. Mr. Frank's looks kind of scared me, though, because he looked for all the world like somebody that was crazy. I never saw a man look like he did, and I never want to see another look like that again. The panic calculations of a frantic murderer probably prompted Frank to think of a better option. Bribe Conley into silence and pin the one body on the unsuspecting watchman Newt Lee, due at the factory later that evening. And there was a footnote. In his affidavit of May 29, 1913, Conley claimed that when he emerged from the cabinet, he said, goodness alive, you kept me in there a mighty long time. To which Frank replied, yes, I see I did. You are sweated. Next section, the murder notes, bribery, and burning the body. After recounting the wardrobe incident, Conley then described how the handwritten notes found next to Mary Fagan's body were created. Black quote. And then Frank said, can you write? And I said, yes, sir, a little bit. And he'd taken his pencil to fix up some notes. I was willing to do anything to help Mr. Frank because he was a white man and my superintendent. And he sat down, and I sat down at the table, and Mr. Frank dictated the notes to me. Whatever it was, it didn't seem to suit him, and he told me to turn over and write again. And I turned the paper over and wrote again. And when I'd done that, he told me to turn over again, and I turned over again, and he wrote on the next page there. And he looked at that and kind of liked it, and he said that was all right. Then he reached over and got another piece of paper, a green piece, and he told me what to write. He took it and laid it on his desk and looked at me smiling and rubbing his hands, and then he pulled out a nice little roll of greenbacks and he said, "Here is $200. And I taken the money and looked at it a little bit and I said, "Mr. Frank, don't you pay another dollar for that watchman, jeweler, because I will pay him myself." Because he was paying the loans out. He had bought something and Frank was, I guess, on a loan, and Frank was paying it dollar by dollar out of every salary that the black got. Typical sort of Jew action. And he said, "All right, I don't see what you want to buy a watch for either. That big fat wife of mine wanted me to buy an automobile, and I wouldn't do it." Big fat wife. So he likes small Aryan girls, small underage Aryan girls, and he doesn't like his big fat Jew wife. Two of the four notes Connolly said he composed were found next to the body of Mary Fagan, and they appear to have been intended to place the blame for the crime on the Black Knight Watchman. Frank then ordered that Connolly burn Mary Fagan's body. Long quote here. And after a while, Mr. Frank looked at me and said, "You go down there in the basement and you take a lot of trash and burn that package that's in front of the furnace." And I told him, "All right." But I was afraid to go down there by myself, and Mr. Frank wouldn't go down there with me. He said, "There's no need of my going down there." And I said, "Mr. Frank, you were a white man and you done it, and I'm not going down there and burn that myself." He looked at me then, kind of frightened, and he said, "Let me see that money." And he took the money back and put it back in his pocket. And I said, "Is this the way you do things?" And he said, "You keep your mouth shut. That is all right." And Mr. Frank turned around in his chair and looked at the money, and he looked back at me and folded his hands and looked up and said, "Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn." And he looked down when he said that, and I looked up at him, and he was looking up at the ceiling, and I said, "Mr. Frank, what about me?" He said, "That's all right. Don't you worry about this thing. You just come back to work Monday like you don't know anything and keep your mouth shut. If you get caught, I will get you out on bond and send you away." And he said, "Can you come back this evening and do it?" And I said, "Yes, that I was coming to get my money." He said, "Well, I am going home to get dinner, and you come back here in about 40 minutes and I will fix the money." And I said, "How will I get in?" And he said, "There will be a place for you to get in, all right. But if you are not coming back, let me know and I will take those things, murder notes, and put them down with the body." And I said, "All right, I'll be back in about 40 minutes. Connolly said he then left the factory and went to a bar, had a beer with a patron, interacted with several people, and went home and slept until 6:30 that evening. Connolly then explained his first subsequent rendezvous with Frank 3 days later at the factory. Block quote. "I saw him next time on Tuesday on the fourth floor when I was sweeping. He walked up and he said, 'Now remember, keep your mouth shut.' And I said, 'All right.' And he said, 'If you'd come back on Saturday and done what I told you to do with it down there, there wouldn't have been no trouble.'" And that's where we're going to end that for this section. So, as unreliable, dishonest, sleazy as blacks tend to be, in this case, the black told the truth, and it was pretty much evident to everyone that he was telling the truth. And it did lead to a conviction, so good. Anyway, thanks for being with me today. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I'll be back with you again for more from the Nation of Islam's book about Leo Frank, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, real soon.